would nuclear war mean for our survival as a species?
It's very clear that whichever side goes first on the scale that U.S. and Russia have prepared to do and planned, rehearsed, threatened, and deployed weapons, if they carry out those plans, nearly everyone starves to death.
That's Daniel Ellsberg. We talk with him about his shocking new book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. Then we talk with peace and security studies analyst Michael Clare about his recent article in The Nation, Trump's Nuclear Posture Review, Back to Armageddon. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rihanna. Well, it's official. On January 25th, the doomsday clock ticked forward 30 seconds to rest at 2 minutes to midnight. That means we're closer now to thermonuclear war than at any time since the Cold War, according to the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. And with our president having mused aloud, "If we have nuclear weapons, why can't we use them?" the threat of all-out nuclear war seems graver than ever. But it's not like it ever went away, even after the fall of the Soviet Union. In fact, as my guest, legendary Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg writes in his explosive new book, The Doomsday Machine, every president since Truman has prepared for nuclear war on a hair-trigger basis. He knows, because he was the high-level defense analyst who wrote the plans for nuclear war in the 1960s. In fact, Ellsberg intended to reveal those plans after he released the Pentagon Papers. But his copied first-hand source material got lost. In the decades since, the original copies have been declassified, and Ellsberg now reveals it all in his shocking first-hand account of America's nuclear program. I spoke with Daniel Ellsberg last month via Skype. Daniel Ellsberg, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
This book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner, is, as you write, a chronicle of human madness. And I'll quote from you, "The hidden reality I aim to expose is that for over 50 years, all-out thermonuclear war has been a catastrophe waiting to happen. And that is still true today." So tell us, Daniel Ellsberg, what would be the actual impact if we bombed, say, North Korea?
North Korea doesn't have enough warheads, from 20 to 60 at the most, to cause nuclear winter. But the nuclear winter is a phenomenon that we've known about for over the last third of a century here, confirmed very much in terms of calculations in the last 10 years. And that means that a large-scale war with Russia, for example, between Russia and the U.S., hundreds of cities and firestorms, which means that updrafts from the nuclear explosions would loft the smoke, hundreds of millions of tons of smoke from these burning cities into the stratosphere where it wouldn't burn out and where it would go around the globe very quickly, reducing sunlight by some 70% and killing all the harvests. It would be essentially a year-round winter. It would be like conditions of the Ice Age, basically, and ending all food supplies, not only for humans, but for animals that depend on food, animals that depend on other animals, depend on vegetation. The world's supply of food at any given time for the human population is about 60 days. That's concentrated in countries like the U.S., which export food a lot, so we would last longer than some of the others, which would starve first. But ultimately, a war like that would lead to the near extinction of the human species. Not everyone. There might be 1% or less, or a little bit more, in Australia or New Zealand eating fish and mollusks. And that's a fair number of people, 70 million people. It might be 10 million, it might be 100 million. But most humans would have died, and entire extinction would have occurred for nearly all other large animals. They aren't as adaptable as we are. They aren't as mobile. They can't adapt to different climates and winter conditions like that. So it really means the end of our world, of the world of humans and of most large animals. Now, to come back to your question, that would probably not be the immediate effect in a war with North Korea, as it would be in a war with Russia, unless there were a serious false alarm in the course of that war affecting either the U.S. or Russia, which led them to believe that they were under attack. Just recently, before we talk here, there have been two false alarms, one in Hawaii and one in Japan. Those have actually occurred, and that would raise the risk of a full-scale war that would end everything. In the case of Korea, we're talking about deaths not of billions, as that nuclear winter would involve, but millions, only millions, except that they would occur within a day or a week. It would be more violence, more deaths by a violent conflict in a day or a week than has ever occurred in human history in that period. And the world that would come after that would almost certainly be a more dangerous one than we've ever experienced. There would be much more proliferation. Other countries would be getting nuclear weapons. India and Pakistan, which now have only fission-type weapons of the kind used on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, would be testing thermonuclear weapons, which can be 1,000 times greater in yield. And a war right now, finally, between India and Pakistan using only fission weapons and only perhaps, I say only, 100 weapons, which is less than they have, would starve to death by its effect on sunlight. It would reduce sunlight by only about 7%, and that would starve the most malnourished people in the world from 1 billion to 2 billion, about a third of the Earth's population. So that would, as I say, be a risk that we would live thereafter, after a war with North Korea. And if there was retaliation directly on the U.S., it would probably change our form of government very decisively to something closer to martial law than to democracy. So we're talking now about a war that's very small by comparison with U.S. and Russia, and yet which would be absolutely calamitous.
Well, that's terrifying enough. Now, what is the doomsday machine that you refer to in your book? Is it a system, a technology, or a frame of mind?
It's all of those, but of course, without the frame of mind, the technology wouldn't have come into existence, and it should never have come into existence in the form it exists. I'm talking now about not a single device, but a system of thousands of vehicles and warheads. Mostly thermonuclear H-bomb warheads in both the U.S. and Russia. And on either side, the consequences that I've just described would be likely in the event that our larger war plans that have actually existed for the use of these weapons were actually carried out. Whether they aimed explicitly at cities or not, they would be aimed at military targets in or near cities, command and control centers, transportation, air defenses, which would burn the cities, whether they were targeted or not, and have this result on the smoke. That's the sense, then, in which this system constitutes a system of near extinction of human life. The original doomsday machine idea conceived by my colleague Herman Kahn at the RAND Corporation was a conceptual idea that would kill everything, actually all life. Well, nuclear winter wouldn't quiet that, but it would come close enough, I think, to be called a doomsday machine. And that's what both the U.S. and the Russia have had for over half a century now.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Daniel Ellsberg about his new book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. Yeah, and you say that the basic elements of American readiness for nuclear war remain today what they were almost 60 years ago. Just setting aside for the moment the absolute insanity that anybody could contemplate any of this, could you sum up those basic elements before we go into more details about them, those basic elements of our readiness for nuclear war?
Well, the key aspect of the danger is that there has been what amounts to a hoax or a delusion for over half a century, that by launching our weapons first, by striking first before adversary weapons have actually reached any targets in our country, they may be on their way, or we may have intelligence that tells us they're about to attack, but that it's advantageous to strike first rather than strike second, no matter how bad the consequences. The military can be realistic to the point of saying, yes, it will be disastrous. It will be terrible consequences if we go first for both sides, but less bad if we go first than if we go second. And that sounds plausible, except that in the nuclear era, it's wrong. It doesn't matter particularly whether you go first or second. In particular, in the light of the nuclear winter, the smoke aspect, which was ignored for the first 40 years or so of the nuclear era, nobody had really even looked into the question of how much smoke would be generated, would be lofted into the stratosphere, and what the effects of that would be. But in the last 30 years, when they've been looking at it, it's very clear that whichever side goes first on the scale that U.S. and Russia have prepared to do and planned and rehearsed and threatened and deployed weapons, if they carry out those plans, nearly everyone starves to death within a year or two, whether they've gone first or second. So this notion from earlier technologies, from pre-nuclear age, really, that having the first strike is very advantageous or even decisive, and which may have had some plausibility in the very earliest days of the nuclear era when there were only relatively few weapons and they were quite vulnerable, has had no real meaningful application at all to the last half century when each side, the U.S. and Russia, have submarine-launched nuclear weapons, which are invulnerable, essentially, to missile attack. They can't be targeted. And so whatever you've done to the command and control and the missiles of the other side, you're still going to suffer the consequences of an attack from the sub-launched missiles, which will be thoroughly annihilating. There's another almost crazy aspect to the plans. They've always aimed at hitting the command and control, the central command of the other side, with the thought that perhaps that will paralyze them. They won't be able to respond at all. And in that context, that's the only one strategy that holds out any hope of coming out fairly intact from such a war. The only problem is that neither side has wanted to be paralyzed by having its central command hit. And therefore, I discovered in the late 50s and early 60s what even incoming President John F. Kennedy didn't know until I told his assistant for national security, that Eisenhower had delegated authority to use nuclear weapons in case there was an outage of communications or events were moving so swiftly they were under attack that they didn't have time to communicate, or the president himself was incapacitated in some fashion. They delegated authority to launch weapons to high-level commanders who had in turn delegated it below that to lower-level commanders. Just how many people had authorization under some circumstances to launch nuclear weapons irreversibly? No one knew. I doubt if any president has ever really known that, or leader of the Soviet Union. But almost the same thing almost surely applies to North Korea. Kim Jong-un, very unlikely to have allowed it to be the case that his nuclear capabilities would be paralyzed from retaliating if he were attacked. And, of course, we're always advertising the fact that we planned a possible decapitation of the Kim Jong-un regime. He's almost surely made provisions for such a capability. Just as we speak, there's a news story in the New York Times that where the new Pentagon planning for nuclear policy accepts the existence of a Russian torpedo capability, so-called torpedo, which would be an underwater nuclear warhead that would be launched from a submarine, but would travel hundreds of miles under artificial intelligence controls that would guide it in the event of a loss of communications with Moscow. And they would cause enormous radioactive contamination of our seashore when it exploded offshore. It caused enormous radioactivity. Well, that's the kind of preparation that both sides have made in various ways. And it allows the possibility then of the devastation of our species. That's insane. But the threat of it is not regarded as insane. It's the threat of an insane action. And we live with the idea that, well, risking it and threatening it and preparing for it is not as insane as actually carrying it out. But it's, the thought is, well, no, it's reasonable. We get various benefits from it. People will back down. They will be afraid to confront us. And there's some truth to that. But the benefits are just enormously outweighed by the possibility that these things will actually will go off. And that possibility is not zero. It absolutely is not zero. And any possibility of it all is unjustifiable.
You talk in this book, Daniel Ellsberg, you talk in The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner, about first strike instability. You know, as you said, people tend to want to fire first because you think it's the only way to be sure of preventing your own obliteration. But in fact, that itself causes a heightened risk of mistake. Talk about, you know, how close we have gotten to the brink of nuclear war just through mistakes and misreadings of things.
Well, in 1980, Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was the national security assistant to President Carter, got a call at about between 2:30 and 3 in the morning that some 200 Soviet missiles were on their way. And that meant to him that everyone, he knew that our country was about to be obliterated in less than 30 minutes. He had, he figured, 2 minutes to get this confirmed and then 4 minutes for the president to decide how to respond. And he didn't choose to wake up his wife, who was sitting next to him when he got this phone call, lying next to him in bed. Because what was the use of waking her up just to be told that it was all about to go? But he was preparing to tell the president. And he gets another call, a second call to confirm this, saying, no, it's 2,200 missiles, not 200 missiles, even worse, and so forth. So he's about 1 minute from picking up the red phone and calling the president in the middle of the night when he does get a third call that it was, after all, a mistake. It had been, it turned out, apparently, a computer chip had generated this, a faulty chip, 46-cent worth chip, that had generated this, as it did several other times that year before they finally found the source of the trouble. Well, he says, actually, in an interview he said later, he said, I felt that I wanted to be sure we didn't go alone. Now, that was very helpful. He wanted to be sure that SAC, Strategic Air Command, command planes got off, that the planes were all ready to get off the ground or got off the ground. The command planes actually did go off and get off the ground. But no one really asks in the course of this, what difference could it possibly have made if he'd told the president any more than telling his wife? Well, it would make a difference perhaps to hundreds of millions of Russians. So they would be sure to go with us. Of course, this happened to be in 1980. Within a couple of years, we learned that we would all have gone, and all the faster by burning Russian cities as well as American cities. That's happened several times. In 1979, there was an even more serious mistake when somebody actually made the mistake of putting a training tape that simulated an entire attack with submarines and planes and missiles and everything coming at us. And it was, again, many minutes before someone realized it was that. They weren't getting signals directly from our radars that things were on the way, but the tape was simulating all that. What people learned in Hawaii recently, when they got a false alarm that a missile attack was on the way, was they became aware, about a million of them, for a matter of 38 minutes, of the actual situation in which the entire world has been living for more than half a century, and that is that we're all 30 minutes away from a mistake on the other side of the world, from a decision by either someone acting on routine on the basis of false alarm or a madman of some sort who's launched it all. In other words, that our whole world is contingent and is living sort of on sufferance of the stability and the stability of all our systems, our electronic systems, and infrared. This is an insane situation. It's like living on the slopes of Vesuvius, where we have, in fact, created the potential for a total explosion. And it's gone on in secret, and with the advantage that it seems to provide us an intimidating role in various crises that will cause other people to step carefully lest they provoke us into blowing the world up. Well, that's the advantage. The disadvantage being that we've created the capability for blowing the world up, and we've inspired other people to do exactly the same and to build their own doomsday machines. So we've seen now in Hawaii and Japan the recent possibility, the continued possibility of human error. But the truth is, I think, that it was a human error ever to create these large systems that could, in fact, exterminate us. That was a human error. And it's been error after year of appropriating for these things and improving them and enlarging them. And at this point, President Obama, and now following him, President Trump, have scheduled a $1 trillion modernization of our doomsday machines, of the missiles that are vulnerable on the ground, that urge the commander to use them before he loses them in the event of possibly wrong warning, to get hundreds of sub-launched missiles going, where a fraction of those would be more than enough for deterrence, but where we've actually put in enough for nuclear winter, for extermination, in the subs alone and the planes. So it's a chain of errors, of human errors, a web of generations here of human errors. Either as humans, we learn how and we bring ourselves to correct those errors by dismantling these machines, or we will eventually be annihilated at their hands. Those are the two possibilities.
You know, you yourself, in your late 20s, you came to be working on guidance for nuclear war plans that you even knew then would kill hundreds of millions of people, although you didn't know that it would actually kill billions and billions of people.
Right.
What was your mindset as you did this? Because I think this is very much kind of the subtext of this book and something that you have been alluding to in this interview quite a few times as well. I mean, this is insanity. Yet you also participated in this. As you look back on who you were then, what do you remember of what you were thinking?
Well, it is a confession, but at the time that I was in other words, of a participation that I don't feel any pride in, on the contrary, you know, that I'm ashamed of not having questioned the assumptions and the realities more than I did at that time. But the false reality that I was responding to was the top secret estimates that the Soviets were far ahead of us in building ICBMs at a time when we had very few, and that they had hundreds on the way to thousands. In fact, in 1961, in the middle of 61, when I was 30 years old, the head of the Strategic Air Command personally estimated that the Soviets at that time had 1,000 ICBMs. I heard that from his chief of war plans in Offutt base in Omaha. The reality, which we learned about a month later when we got adequate coverage from our reconnaissance satellites, was that the Soviets had 4 missiles, not 1,000 that General Power had estimated, and not the several hundred or 150 or 160 that CIA and others had more conservatively estimated, but 4, essentially none, really. In other words, we'd been living in an entirely false reality. And that reality we saw as basically facing Hitler with nuclear weapons, a very, very ominous supposed reality that came out of World War I, where really I can't blame the initial Manhattan Project scientists for their urgency, their determination not to allow the Germans to have a monopoly of nuclear weapons. There was every reason to fear that the Germans, who had first discovered nuclear fission in Germany and recognized it in 1938-39 could well be ahead of us in their efforts to have nuclear weapons. And the idea of Hitler with nuclear weapons was indeed one that it was hard to accept. And we had to try to prevent him from having any monopoly of any such kind of weapons. But in early 1945, when Germany surrendered, and really before that, some 6 months to 9 months for various people, it was clear that the Germans had not had a crash program as we did for nuclear weapons. At that point, the highest priority with nuclear weapons, I've been thinking recently, should have been to realize this genie must not escape from the bottle. They must not be tested. They must not be developed. They must not be deployed. And at least whether it would have been possible or not to prevent, let's say, a development in Russia, which was the most likely other country to get them, that should have been the highest priority. And for some, a few scientists, it was. But their views didn't even get. They were prevented from getting to President Harry Truman. I don't think he realized at all what he was setting out on when he set out both to test the weapons in July and then to use them in August against Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It was obvious from that point on that what we had here was a technology that had the potential for ending human civilization and much else. And people did understand that, but rather than put all their intellectual creativity and their efforts toward trying to make that end point, as unlikely as possible, to try to stop it. Instead, people were allowed to just see the possibility that this would give us world domination, or at least a kind of security that wouldn't be possible any other way, and that we had to seek our own monopoly, which we did have for 4 years, and then only, and then to try to keep a superiority in a world where superiority is meaningless, in the sense that an actual nuclear war that takes place between two major nuclear powers like the U.S. and Russia, at the end point of that would be such devastation that the idea that one had won a victory would just be a mockery. It would be ridiculous. And no matter whether one started out with 10 times as much as the other or 100 times, the devastation on both sides would be irrecoverable. So we never really shifted from that mentality. That's the problem. As I say, but when I came along in the late 50s, we still were able to imagine that there was a country that was far ahead of us at that point, and that may had some meaning. That was wrong. And again, we never really adjusted. Well, then what can we do in the way of agreements and investigation? The Soviets actually made on a number of occasions, even under Stalin and after Stalin, where they proposed major disarmament collaboration of various kinds. And we never paid really much attention to those at all. Now, they might not have been serious or to be trusted, and yet, facing this, it's the fact that the U.S. never has explored the idea of accepting any position other than some kind of superiority in nuclear weapons, has never really been serious about trying either to avoid the operation of a doomsday machine, which is what we have, or to try to eliminate them, as we promised to try to do in Article 6 of the Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Yes, and perhaps that's at the root of the insanity, that dominance must be won at all costs. But one of the things you talk about, Daniel Ellsberg, in this book, The Doomsday Machine, is the issue of delegation. And delegation of the authority to authorize a nuclear attack is something people are wondering about now, with a president who seems highly unstable and impulsive. On the other hand, your book explores perhaps an even more scary possibility, which is that delegation has allowed all kinds of people to be in a position to set off nuclear war. What's your sense of both possibilities?
It's almost necessarily the case that a major nuclear power has made preparations that it can't be paralyzed from retaliating. It can't by a single blow on a central node or on a commander-in-chief. And we can assume that all the others have made preparations. We know that the Russians have, and we have, and I would say almost certainly North Korea has made preparations that others would be able to launch these weapons even if their higher commanders had been destroyed. Now, whether you regard it as which is most frightening, that Trump himself can launch these weapons, which he can. He doesn't have a button, by the way. There isn't a single button here for this, but it's a question of conveying orders one way or another with an authenticating code showing that it's not just the voice of Donald Trump, but that he has a code. But that code doesn't lock up other weapons. It just assures that the person getting the order knows that he's hearing it from the president. Is it even more worrisome to think that not only Donald Trump can do it, but lots of others can do it as well? I suppose it is. It's, it certainly is worrisome to think that Donald J. Trump can destroy most life on Earth if he chooses. Richard Nixon, in his final days as he was facing impeachment, actually told congressmen more than once, I could go into the next room and pick up a phone and 80 million people would die, he said, within an hour. Well, 80 million is a very conservative number. That means a very limited attack he'd made. In fact, it would be much more than that. But that was a frightening thing to hear from a president. Well, from Donald Trump, could say the same. Yes, he can do that. Is there some human that we really trust with that kind of temptation and that kind of grandiose empowerment? How about George Washington or Abraham Lincoln? We might say, well, they're much more sober types. But should the existence of humanity really depend on the mood of any one person like that? Or, even worse, on the capabilities of dozens or scores of people who could actually launch weapons? That seems to answer itself. You know, we shouldn't have to depend on that, and we do. And unless we actually change our focus entirely from how do we use these weapons to intimidate and to enlarge our own role in alliances and get our way, change that to how do we eliminate this danger to the human species and to other species, we're on a course that is very likely over time to end history, to end our existence. Those are the choices, to keep going as we are toward an abyss or to turn around and move toward the elimination of this threat to existence.
Daniel Ellsberg talking about his new book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. We'll talk more after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Daniel Ellsberg about nuclear war and just how close we could be to it. His new book is called The Doomsday Machine. Just before the break, we were talking about how the authority to launch nuclear weapons lies not just with the President of the United States, but also has been delegated to others, thereby greatly increasing the risk of war. I asked Ellsberg, given the evident instability and impulsiveness of our current president, whether there are any checks on Trump's power to push the button.
Well, there are somewhat different procedures for doing this under different circumstances. Apparently, and they may vary from administration to administration, I don't have the details on the latest ones, obviously. I did know pretty well long ago, and the basic framework has stayed the same. But it's reported that the president can actually give orders directly to Strategic Command, which controls his weapons. And the next question would be, it's not as though he's simply giving those orders to a computer, let's say, or he's pressing a button himself. The president himself can't simply launch weapons the way someone launched an alert mistakenly in Hawaii the other day, simply by pressing the wrong computer button. It's not as simple as that. So the people who receive his orders can, in principle, say, sir, you know, that is wrong. That shouldn't happen. I don't want to do that. In theory, they could say, I refuse. That would be unconstitutional. It would be illegal of them. Yes, but they could do that humanly. However, he can also replace them from 1 minute to the next, essentially. Say, you're out. And get somebody in there who will, in fact, carry out these orders. And all our historical experience tells us, I would say, that a president can get those orders obeyed if he wants. The idea that more mature and prudent individuals can save us in this case is not very reliable. These people are trained, above all, as military men especially, to carry out, as in the charge of the Light Brigade, orders on which someone has blundered, and they go into the jaws of death. It's not reassuring at this moment that the most adult person in the cabinet, General James Mattis, has the nickname Mad Dog. And the same if Mattis, if Mad Dog himself, decided that the president was hesitating too long and we had to go ahead, he could send out those orders. And is there a clear system for stopping that? There wasn't in my day. A while ago, once an execute order had gone out, there was no provision for a stop order. Interestingly, that was the case on this alert, just as we speak here just very recently. Well, that's not as dangerous as an execute order for missiles. But do we have a system that could actually counteract that? I would say constitutionally first, no. The president has the ability to do that. But are there ways of making the system look and be safer? Probably yes. And Congress has never, as far as I'm aware, actually investigated how this system works, used an independent eye on it, either on the controls of it or on the targets. They have been able. It's been held too secret for civilian eyes and for congressional eyes. That should change. If there's anything, if I have one specific goal from this book, if I could inspire something, it would be for a new Congress. I would have little hope for this Congress. But a new Congress, and I would have to say one better with respect to this problem than anyone we've seen, to come into office and to investigate this and really act to change the system. You know, a problem we haven't talked about here at all is that probably the major advantage of building and maintaining these weapons is that they produce profits for private, huge corporations like Boeing, Lockheed, Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, and jobs and votes in those states and in retirement roles for generals when they leave the service, and not much against them. In other words, the movement that did exist in the 80s and to some extent the 90s, went away with the thought that the Cold War had totally removed the rationale for these weapons, which it had, such as that rationale was, crazy as it was, it disappeared with the disappearance of the Soviet Union. But the weapons didn't go away, and they remain on alert, on hair trigger alert, ready to respond to a false alarm of the kind we just saw. That is, I think it's only an American problem, or to start with, it's very much Russian as well, but it's also nine other nuclear states. It's a species problem here, especially as our, in the numbers we have and organized in nation states the way we are, and with war is still as firmly institutionalized as it is, there's a real question whether this species will manage not to destroy itself with the technology it's been clever enough to create.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with legendary Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg about his new book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. So dismantling the Doomsday Machine, one of the things we've just talked about is what Congress could do to, quote, make it safer, unquote. But that's just one small step on the way. What do we need to do to dismantle it, and what can we do to make that happen?
What can we do? I would say, by the way, that it is essential but not sufficient to have a new Congress with a Democratic majority. Even in one house, the possibility for investigation would be there. That has never been done in a way that's never been done. So we should elect new people, mainly Democrats, I would say, who were aware of this issue and willing to act on it. And that means, by the way, Democrats better from this point of view than we've seen in the past. In other words, just merely going back to where we were before when there was a Democratic majority did not lead to investigation, hearings, or any change in the system. So in 2018, in 2020, I think we can aim at getting candidates and others who make this an issue and who are aware of it and prepared to act on it. When they do, it means putting people to work. It means other than constructing and reconstructing a doomsday machine. It means giving Boeing other work to do, I would say, and working on other than new intercontinental missiles on which they're bidding right now for building. We should be willing to spend, if we needed to, and we don't, billions and billions of dollars to dismantle those machines, to get rid of them, even unilaterally. They are dangerous to our security. But instead, we go along the same proven paths of building them and distributing the jobs and the votes and all through all 50 states as closely as possible. So it's very hard to change it. But not impossible. That's all I can say. By the way, I didn't invent these recommendations. Former Secretary of Defense William Perry, a physicist, no one has more experience in this field than William J. Perry, and he has proposed for years getting rid of the so-called land-based leg of our supposed triad, the intercontinental ballistic missiles, and canceling the new air-launched missiles. And he's proposed against any new ones, a no first use policy. It's also true of people who headed the Strategic Command, like General Cartwright, or the first head of Strategic Command, General Lee Butler, have made these proposals. But as I say, the votes, the jobs, the profits are on the other side of that issue. And that has outweighed the risk to human survival so far. Can we rise to this challenge? I don't know. No one can prove we can't, though the history is not encouraging. The history means that the likelihood of our changing them is not high, but it's not zero. And that's what we need to do in order to survive. What's incumbent on us is to change course.
And it needs to be massive, and it needs to be soon. Thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you.
Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg. His new book is The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. Read an excerpt at writersvoice.net. Next up, we talk about Trump's newly announced nuclear posture review. The Trump administration announced its new nuclear posture or nuclear policy this week, and it's terrifying. It calls for increasing the role of nuclear weapons in U.S. foreign policy strategy, along with a $1.2 trillion investment in new nuclear weapons. Some of those weapons would make it far easier to start a nuclear war than ever before. My guest, Hampshire College Professor of Peace and Security Studies, Michael Clare, says Trump's nuclear policy will only increase the risk of confrontation with the other nuclear powers, including Russia and China. Michael Clare, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
You have written an article for The Current Nation magazine, Trump's Nuclear Posture Review. Back to Armageddon. In fact, you say that if all of Trump's nuclear weapons policies are enacted, we'll soon find ourselves in a world as terrifying as that of the darkest days of the Cold War. And I have to tell you, I remember those days, and I remember as a 12-year-old in October of, what was it, 1962, I was absolutely terrified because I felt that I was about to die.
I remember those days well myself. I was a college student then at Columbia University, not far from what we all assume was Ground Zero, Times Square, and I thought I was going to be incinerated. I know what you mean.
So now Trump has, you said, rolled back Obama's policies, his Obama's nuclear posture review, as it's called, the NPR. First, tell us, what were Obama's nuclear weapons policies?
Now, we have to distinguish between the overarching guidance within which these policies were framed and then the actual specifics of the policies. And it's more the overarching guidance that struck me. Obama's overarching theme was that we can and should move to a world without nuclear weapons. Now, he made clear this was not going to be easy and it wouldn't happen overnight, but that was the goal. And everything that we were going to do in the meantime was to move us in that direction. What's different about the Trump nuclear posture review is that we're moving in the opposite direction. We're moving towards a world in which nuclear weapons use appears ever more likely, and every step we take is aimed at improving our capacity to fight and win a nuclear war. So it's a 180-degree difference.
And yet, I remember just before Obama left office that he announced a $1 trillion program to update our nuclear weapons, which sounds like it might be the same program that Trump has just announced he will be doing. So talk about this disconnect between Obama's, general NPR and his announcement as he was leaving.
Well, he didn't actually announce a $1.2 trillion nuclear buildup. He said that because our existing nuclear delivery systems were reaching the end of their lifespan, he had to prepare for the possibility that future presidents might need to replace them. And therefore, he set in motion a process of investigating what their replacements would look like. He never authorized their acquisition or procurement. He just set in process the process of developing what a replacement might look like. So he never made that decision. Now, President Trump says, yes, we have to go ahead and procure all of those weapons at a cost of $1.5 trillion over a 30-year period. So there is a difference there.
Break down the Trump policy, the Trump nuclear review. It's not just about boosting military spending. You say he's going to boost military spending, is going to procure additional munitions, and develop an array of new weapons. So break Break these out and explain them to us.
Well, we have to begin with what's called the strategic triad, the three legs of America's retaliatory capability, deterrent capability, it's called. There are three parts of that. There are land-based intercontinental ballistic missiles, ICBMs for short. Those are Minuteman missiles. There are 400 of them now deployed. Then there are submarine-launched ballistic missiles, SLBMs. Those are on submarines, launched from submarines. And then we have bombers, which are intended to penetrate Soviet airspace. And I say Soviet airspace because that's what they were designed to do when they were built. And they carry bombs that you drop or air-launched cruise missiles. So those are the three legs of the system. All of them will be replaced if the Trump plan goes ahead. Now, in addition to that, he wants to, or his staff wants to, introduce additional nuclear weapons that would be used on the battlefield, by which I mean not to blow up cities in a retaliatory strike, but to be used against military targets in a hypothetical war, say, between NATO and Russian forces in Eastern Europe. And these could include a new kind of air-launched cruise missile or a new kind of submarine-launched cruise missile or other gravity bombs that would have a smaller explosive yield than the existing weapons in the U.S. arsenal.
Now, originally, our nuclear weapons policy was the idea that if you had mutually assured destruction, it would be a deterrent to war. But these kinds of nuclear weapons, including maybe you can explain them, low yield nuclear munitions, actually increase the likelihood.
Well, now there's an argument about this, of course. The Trump administration in their new nuclear posture review say that if we have these tactical, so-called tactical nuclear weapons, that nobody would be tempted to use similar weapons of their own against us. So this would be a deterrent against the use of similar weapons by Russia or China, for example. I believe otherwise. I believe that if you have these lower yield weapons in your stockpile, it might make it more likely that somebody would be tempted to use nuclear weapons in a future battlefield where you don't know who's winning or losing, the conditions are murky. It would make it more likely that somebody will use a nuclear weapon than not.
And Trump has also just announced a plan to use nuclear weapons if we're like attacked in a non-nuclear way, e.g., by a cyber attack, which just seems completely bonkers.
That's right. The nuclear posture review says we have to be prepared for using nuclear weapons as a response to a variety of non-nuclear attacks that might include, for example, attacks on our space systems or our vital infrastructure by cyber weapons.
So now, in all of this, there must be an enormous boon to U.S. military contractors.
Well, $1.5 trillion is a lot of money to spend on new weapon systems, for sure. And they're, of course, keen to go ahead with this. There's new missiles to build, new submarines, and a new bomber they're talking about.
$1.5 trillion, it sounds exactly like the amount of the deficit that the Republican tax plan is going to put into effect. This is going to have to go through congressional authorization to finance all these new weapons. Could you talk about kind of the economic implications of this?
Yes, of course. Needless to say, Congress will have to authorize all of this money. and it's going to have to come from somewhere. It's either going to increase the national debt, or it's going to have to come from somewhere else, in the budget. That is, you know, given that there's a tax cut, meaning there'll be less tax revenues coming in. How Congress is going to juggle all of this, I have no idea. I certainly don't think that the Trump administration has any idea how this is going to work.
Although we do have Ryan's word that he's going to go after Social Security and Medicare.
Of course. Well, yes. You know, certainly there are people in the Republican side of Congress who are prepared to cut everything that this country needs to live on: health, education, infrastructure, everything else.
So what can we do as citizens to try to head this off? Because I can tell you that between your article and my recent interview with Daniel Ellsberg about his book, Doomsday, The Doomsday Machine, I'm having trouble sleeping at night.
There are two elements to this, Francesca, that we have to think about. One is contesting the very notion that nuclear war is thinkable, winnable, and something that we want to promote. And we were saying earlier that we could remember a time when that was something that all of us were aware of in the Cold War days, and there was a large anti-nuclear movement at the time. That has disappeared. And I think on one hand, we have to revive that anti-nuclear movement and make it very clear that this notion of making nuclear weapons more usable, which is the word they use, making nuclear weapons more usable, that we utterly reject that notion. So that's part of it. It's an intellectual or a moral statement that has to be made. Then there's the specifics, the financing of all of this. And that's where we speak to our representatives on Capitol Hill and say not one dime for new nuclear weapons. And here I think there will be allies, perhaps, who are Republicans, who are concerned about the bulging national debt, which is only going to get worse with the tax cut, and with competing priorities for infrastructure and the opioid epidemic. And we have to make the case that additional nuclear weapons are not a priority given those other pressing issues.
And especially because they make us so much less safe. Michael Clare, thank you so much for talking with us here. Your article is Trump's Nuclear Posture Review, Back to Armageddon. Thanks again.
My pleasure.
Michael Clare is professor of peace and security studies at Hampshire College. Find a link to his Nation article, Trump's Nuclear Posture Review, Back to Armageddon, at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.